West Dallas, it's just across the Trinity River from where I've been this week. For decades, it was a ramshackle place, a Superfund site with a cement plant, some crime-ridden warehouses, and a small Latino neighborhood known as La Bajada. But now it's packed with springtime revelers and dog walkers. As KERA's Dwahli Saikautau reports, the engines of this change are restaurants.
This place was kind of like a desert with not so much to do, but it had some of the best views of downtown. Now there's a soaring new bridge that some called the Bridge to Nowhere. But with a dozen new restaurants, nowhere is becoming somewhere.
The Trinity Groves concept has never been done anywhere before.
That's Stuart Fitz, who's sipping iced tea on the broad patio outside a colorful renovated warehouse. He's a principal investor in an 80-acre development project that hopes to generate $3 billion. And it starts with this restaurant incubator.
We knew that the restaurant industry needed concepts. We knew that we wanted to give people a reason to come across the bridge. We knew that we wanted to change the perception from old Dallas that this was a dangerous place. It's not.
Phil Romano, the Macaroni Grill founder who started buying up property here a decade ago, is the food guy behind this project. He says they're catering to and working with millennials.
Okay, I call them new people. That's 18 to 35. They're new. They don't like anything we old people did.
And the idea is bring in young chefs with no money, invest $500,000 in their plan, and then, if they're good, take the business national.
We let him get a chance to get up there at bat, try his idea, and if it works, God bless him, he's got 50% of a deal that's going to go all over the country. And if he can't do it, he's out.
It's kind of like a Shark Tank, but better, he says. The Trinity Grove site now houses a Moroccan restaurant with hookahs and belly dancers. There's a Chinese-Latin mashup, and soon a chocolatier will move in. And all of this just 3 minutes from downtown Dallas. Mike Casas grew up just four blocks from here, but like other young people, he moved out to find a job.
I was driving through the area, and I had already heard about some of the redevelopment. And I came by here at night one day, and I did not recognize the area at all.
Excited, he invited his extended clan back to the old hood to celebrate his 44th birthday. The Casas family queued up at a joint called Hoffman Hots to eat gluten-free New York wieners, some plain, others topped with bruschetta, cheese, avocado, or Asian slaw.
Of all the places that we could go to, I said, well, let's go have one here. The food was really great. I ate here the other day, and I thought it was nice to be able to bring my kids back to experience this part of Dallas.
Oh, and another thing, says Jeff Harrington with the West Dallas Chamber of Commerce, the nearby La Bajada community wasn't forced out to make room for Trinity Groves or its future lofts.
The number one priority that came out for this entire area was preserve La Bajada as a neighborhood. This is completely antithetical to the way things have been done in Dallas before. And they were understandably worried because another neighborhood, which is sort of colloquially referred to as Little Mexico, was basically obliterated back in the 90s by development.
There's still a lot of skepticism about Trinity Groves, but from the packed lots along the riverfront, right now, it's the place to eat. For NPR News, I'm Dwahli Saikautau in Dallas.
The National FFA organization, originally known as Future Farmers of America, has this blue corduroy jacket that's always been an icon of rural life in this country. Truth is, fewer and fewer young people are growing up on farms these days, and yet kids are donning that jacket in record numbers, often in cities and suburbs. Luke Runyon from member station KUNC reports.
18-year-old Reese Melton unlatches the fence leading into a muddy pen at the St. Vrain Valley School District's working farm in Longmont, Colorado, near Denver.
You wouldn't think there's a livestock facility back behind here.
Melton is president of the district's FFA chapter and takes care of the farm's cows, goats, and pigs during school hours, which sometimes serves as joke fodder from his classmates who play sports. And he hears about it.
Reese's got to go to cow class. Reese's got to go to farmer's class. It's like, that's right, I'm going to farmer's class.
Unlike FFA members of the past, Melton didn't grow up on a farm. His parents did. And that's the norm for the 60 other students in his chapter.
We're in an urban area, so most of our members do not grow up on property, though they still have that connection to agriculture.
Most millennials are several generations removed from the farm. That's why the school district is going to great lengths to make agriculture appeal to more students.
So this jacket is just from the 80s.
Lauren Hart is the district's FFA advisor and an agriculture instructor. In her 8 years of teaching, she's noticed a shift. A greater number of students are interested in organic farming methods, grass-fed beef and cage-free eggs. And Hart says she can't just ignore what students want to learn about.
The interest and the ability both of students going into production agriculture is declining. It's just not something that a high school student either wants to or believes they're able to get into.
Hart reaches into areas you wouldn't typically associate with farming: law, public policy, entrepreneurship, and bookkeeping. And that's something that doesn't always sit well with a few students' parents who hail from farm country.
Why aren't you doing XYZ? And when are you going to have my student on a tractor? Well, never.
The perception is that FFA is plows, cows, and sows.
The national organization's CEO, Dwight Armstrong, says programs like Hart's are taking off, and the changing focus appears to be working. Nearly 580,000 students are enrolled in FFA this year, a record for the organization that dates back to the 1920s. Suburban and inner-city chapters in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York are some of the fastest-growing in the country.
Because now we talk about not vocational agriculture, but the science of agriculture and the science of food.
And Armstrong says reframing ag into food science begins to point students on more stable career paths, something that couldn't be said during the 1980s farm crisis. That's when enrollment numbers slumped, the name went from Future Farmers to FFA, and the group's survival mode mantra became adapt or die. Back at the school farm in Longmont, Reese Melton and his classmate Samuel Johnson are planning a coop for a flock of fast-growing chickens. Both have the iconic FFA blue corduroy jackets hanging in their closets at home, which at first, Melton says he griped about wearing.
It's definitely not the most stylish outfit, but it's something that's more relative to tradition.
It's kind of neat that the jacket didn't change throughout the years. It's always been blue corduroy, same emblem and everything.
One tradition that's held on while everything around it changed. For NPR News, I'm Luke Runyon in Greeley, Colorado.
And that story came to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration focusing on agriculture and food.
It's time for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Kelly, good to be with you.
So there is a gold rush going on, but it's not about a metal. It's about a spice. Huh?
All the way from India, turmeric. We get it in a lot of Indian curries, and now it's the latest superfood craze. So Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, all of the healthy places are starting to stock it heavily.
Okay, so it's not just seasoning for Indian food anymore. Now there's companies completely dedicated to turmeric? I mean, mixologists are working it into cocktails. Is this true?
1,000%. So there are all sorts of delicious elixirs, drinks that you can buy. One company is now doing north of $1 million, which is not bad. You've got lotions, you've got soaps. And part of it, Kelly, is a belief that not only has it flavored food, but that it's got healthy properties. And so for years, lots of Indian families, both in India and overseas, have used it against colds. Some people would say they use it for eczema or skin diseases. And even others, our own American Dr. Oz, recommends it for fighting depression.
Wow. I mean, we do import it from India, but now because U.S. demand is going up, we hear some farmers are starting to grow it. Some are even switching from planting rice to planting turmeric. Is it really that big of a deal right now?
You've seen imports from India triple in terms of turmeric, but you're also seeing, as you said, grow elsewhere, grow in warm climates, parts of the states like Hawaii. And some people, you love this, Kelly, are being very cagey about where they're getting their supply from. In fact, supply is so tight that a lot of the folks we talked to wouldn't tell you exactly how they were getting their supply. And so it's been pretty broadly used in India for centuries. And now here in the U.S., people are starting to think about it. You remember that green tea craze, Kelly, that
sure.
For some people still going on?
Mm-hmm.
Think of this as the new green tea.
All right. So it's not just a fad. You think it's here to stay?
I think so. I think in no small part because the second most populous country in the world use it pretty broadly. In addition to doing it for health reasons, it also has some involvement in spiritual ceremonies.
Move over, yoga. Okay, so there's another fad that Ozzy checked up on this week. A number of services popping up to help guys assemble that perfectly styly outfit without actually ever having to enter a store. What's up with that?
You know, personal stylists have been around for a long time.
Sure.
More women have used it than men in recent times, and there have been lots of services, including over the net. But now there are a couple of services for men.
So explain how these services work.
You send in your measurements, arm length, waist, etc. They also, by the way, look at some of your social media indicators, so where you live, because that tells them about climate and other sorts of things. And then they take that information, create a first pass at here are some clothes, shoes, other items that may work for you. And then you get online, or sometimes a person comes directly to you, a stylist who helps you ultimately narrow down the choices. If that works, that same stylist works with you on another set of choices down the road.
I mean, some people really do like to actually shop for themselves. I have a hard time understanding why this would be important to people.
I think it's interesting. So I'm definitely one of those guys who does not like to shop. While you can clearly go online and do it yourself, the reality is a lot of people like me don't have a ton of style and taste and could use some help. And simply getting it from an algorithm isn't enough. You want a human face to it. And so these are kind of interesting blended services. You know, there are a handful of interesting young companies. One's called Bombfell. Another's called the Trunk Club that in various ways are helping mainly young men at this point buy clothes primarily for work.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talk about at npr.org/new and next. Carlos, thanks again.
Kelly, good to be with you.
Grabbing a beer with a friend might sound like a good time to a lot of people, but in Belgium, beer is about more than just a good time. This week, Belgium formally applied to the United Nations cultural arm, UNESCO, to have its so-called beer culture recognized and protected as an honored part of our global cultural heritage. If Belgium has its way, beer culture in that country would join flamenco in Spain and Mexico's mariachi music. So what makes Belgium's beer so great and perhaps worthy of such esteem? To find out, we called up Eric Verdonk in Antwerp, Belgium. He's a beer enthusiast, advocate, and author. Hi there, Eric. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Hi.
So can you describe the beer culture in Belgium? Why is it so exceptional?
Well, I think thanks to the fact that we still have 150 breweries, and many of these are still family-owned, so it's not only a lager, more industrial type of beer tradition. We also kept to our typical traditions like sour beers, for instance, the lambic beers close to Brussels, and of course the famous Trappist and Abbey beers. This is all part of our liquid heritage, if you want.
As I understand it, there is also a religious component to this, too. It's a tradition in Belgium for monks to brew beer, right?
Yes, that's right. And these monks in the abbeys, they were used to brewing beer. And why? You couldn't trust the water in these days. So in fact, it was a very good idea to drink beer because then you boiled the water. So it has been a tradition of brewing beer within abbeys for ages. The Trappist beers are brewed within the abbey walls. Hmm. If you look at the Chimay, for instance, which is quite known in the U.S., that beer is brewed at the Abbey of Chimay.
So why do you think the beer culture in Belgium needs UNESCO recognition or protection? Is it in jeopardy in some way? Are people not respecting it in the way that you would see fit?
Well, I think that the people here are not enough proud of their heritage. And that's because of our mentality. We don't have, say, the more chauvinist mentality of the French who will always promote their wines, but we're so used to it that we take it for granted. And that's why, for us, I think it is important to stress how unique this really is.
Well, thank you so much. Before we let you go, though, how do you say cheers in Flemish?
We would say schol.
Schol. Schol.
Schol.
Schol.
Schol.
Eric, yeah. Schol.
Schol. Thanks.
Eric Verdonk is a Belgian beer expert and author. He joined us from Antwerp, Belgium. We need to go get a beer. Thanks so much, Eric.
See you. Bye-bye.
This is NPR News.